Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 480. Look at us, 480 episodes. Absolute madness. This week's guest is Nikesh Patel. And straight off the bat, I'm going to warn you, this was a little bromance from the get-go. I've been a fan of Nikesh in Man Like Mobeen. It's another series similar to last week with Shoppe. I've had two preview episodes of The Devil's Hour, his new show on Prime, and it's really good. It's really good. There's not been a new show that's reeled me in as easily in a while. So, yeah, big fan of that. Just been in loads of great stuff. Starstruck. He's great. I can't recommend him enough. I think he's fantastic. He's got loads of big things ahead as well. But we proper just hit it off. This was a real conversation that I was like, if we weren't recording this, I'd still be buzzing to have had this chat, because especially a few of the people we talk about, a few of the areas of creativity, a few of the doubts, a few of the inferiority complexes, a few of the bits of love and bits of annoyance about the existence of Ghaz Khan, all real connections. So yeah. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did, because I had a proper good time with this one. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com, where you can get all my merch. There's loads of good stuff there at the most reasonable prices they've ever been, because of how the world is. I mean, we talk a lot of politics at the start of this as well, and I was really pleased with the way that was navigated by Nikesh. Was really good, and particularly as I hadn't pre-warned him. I never pre-warn anyone of anything on this, so I was just like, here we go. Let's throw some heavy discussion at you. And he caught it comfortably and did whatever he wanted with it. That was a weird metaphor. Speechdevelopmentrecords.com, good stuff. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip and twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipYo. Loads of good stuff in all of those places. Let's get on with the podcast, because you're going to hear this, and then you're going to want to get your teeth into The Devil's Hour. There's a particular actor that we fanboy over here that I've probably not mentioned on the podcast before. You might not be that aware of, or you might not be aware that you're aware of them, but I'm a big fan. So I'm going to say their first name now, Alex, because I want it to be I want you to just find out. Alex, if you tune into this, if you hear this, you're welcome. I'd love to have you on the podcast. Reach out. Nikesh, if you want to pass on word to Alex, who's in The Devil's Hour, love to have a chat with you. Anyway, let's get on with the podcast. This is episode 480 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the amazing Nikesh Patel. And we'll begin. Right, I'm here today with Nikesh Patel, and I've just jumped on Zoom and been proper all business, but it's because I can't believe our paths haven't crossed, and I'm excited to chat to you, and I thought I may as well get it all on record. I proper came on and was like, have you got headphones? Are you recording? Okay, let's go.
You're very business, so, you know, set up the environment, and then, you know, we can let rip.
But now we can relax and enjoy it. How are you, man? How is everything going? Are you good?
I'm good, man, yeah. I'm good. I've been looking forward to this. I've been a fan for a while, and, you know, you've chatted to a lot of exciting guests, some of whom are friends of mine. So, yeah. It's a pleasure to sit down with you.
Well, definitely. I've been up for it for a minute. So, and I'm glad we're doing it now, though, because I want to talk to you about The Devil's Hour, because I was sent the first two episodes, and I'm fuming because I have to wait for ages for the rest of them now. It proper hooked me in. And often on these things, you kind of, often I'll agree to having a guest on because I'm a fan of the rest of their work. And then I'll get a preview of what they're doing next. And it'll be like, oh, I don't know about that, but, you know, we'll make it work.
Yeah.
But this is one that I'm like, if we'd recorded this 2 months ago, I would have been annoyed when this came out. And it's like, oh, I wish we'd talked about that. But before we get to all of that, one of the other things I want to talk to you about at some point is Man Like Mobeen because of our mutual friend Gus Kahn. I love that man dearly. But if it's not too heavy a start, I want to start off by talking about, because it's just purely as we record this tomorrow, Gus is putting on an event to raise awareness and funds for all that's going on in Pakistan at the moment. And it's so obviously because of other events in the UK, I guess, it seems to have got so little coverage, and it's devastating what's going on out there. So I thought, again, if it's not too heavy a start, if we can talk about that for a bit. I know you push a lot of political things on socials and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's madness, right? And so much help is needed.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because there's no denying it. It is heavy, is absolutely what it is. Yeah. You know, and I think trying to process the loss of life and also the displacement to Pakistani people because of these floods is horrific, which is why what Gus is doing and you know, the roster he's got together for these fundraisers is brilliant. I'm sadly, I can't make the one on Wednesday, but I'm going on Friday. So yeah, I'll see him and his guests in action then. But there's so much that's fighting to get our attention in this social media age, and you know, any one of us who can, you know, in some small way, I think just I don't think it's even about, you know, I'm not an influencer by any means, but if it's just a little nudge and a little bit of, you know, I like to think that by and large people that are following like you and I are fans of what we do, then, you know, if you can just kind of get turn their gaze to look at something that they might not have thought about.
It got me to add the donation thing onto my Instagram. I saw it on yours, right, and I was like, oh shit, right, I didn't. It's so hard. I know Bishar Ali had shared a whole load of different donation options, and these things can be overwhelming because there's so much help that's needed. But I think it's really weird when things that occur due to natural disasters happen, because I think when there's wars or political conflicts or religious conflicts, it's easier for the West to bury their head in the sand and say, oh, I don't really understand that. I don't understand it, so I don't want to get involved. I don't want to, you know, I don't know who's right and who's wrong. I'm going to just ignore that. But when it's just a straight up tragedy that you don't, again, and to be clear, I don't agree with that. I think you should educate yourself on Israel and Palestine and all these other things. Sure. But I can understand that more. But when it is just a horrific natural disaster, there's no reason to not have huge empathy for this, other than racism or, you know, a geographical thing, the distance. It's easier to distance yourself if it's not in Europe or in England or whatever else, you know.
Yeah, totally. And you know, just to pick up on what you said as well, there's lots of people that have been drawing a direct correlation with, you know, yes, this is a natural disaster, but we can't, you know, I think part of burying our heads in the sand, something I need to educate myself more on, is that, you know, these natural disasters are happening with increasing frequency as a consequence of, you know, stuff that the so-called developing world has been doing for decades. And it's that extra heartbreaking thing that I connected to, and I hope people that didn't really know anything about the region or, you know, or about it geopolitically or anything, it's just that thing, isn't it, of like human beings are, like, personally speaking, I can say people who look like me, I have that I guess that extra connection to it, right? But in a mess that is, I mean, that's sort of trivializing it, isn't it? But that is not of their making.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if people can just take a little bit of time to either educate or donate, which is why I think all these various fundraising things that are going out are great. And, you know, what better way, if you were looking for a fun night out, going to see Gus, now you get to do it in the name of a brilliant cause.
Yeah, 100%.
So, yes, hats off to him.
And again, I think people in the modern era have turned their nose up at times that we have, because of social media and because of easy fundraisers. It's easy to buy your peaceful night's sleep by going, I've donated here or that. In this situation, fucking buy away, mate. Like I don't care why people are doing it. Aid and funds are what are needed. With Israel, Palestine and things like that, it's money and aid is needed, but there's a lot more that's needed there as well. We should be protesting and being active. But with a situation like this, aside from the climate crisis which has caused it, which is hopefully something that's building steam as well, the kind of change to that. This direct situation, I don't care if middle-class white people are buying a peaceful night's sleep as long as they're throwing that money in. Go 100%, ahead. We'll take
it. If it means that, you know, a family have got a roof over their heads and clean water and a home, then I'm completely with you. I think, you know, we can sometimes engage in a bit too much middle-class hand-wringing about am I centering myself and all those discussions are definitely valid, but if you're helping people, then that's got to be the primary goal.
Yeah, however that help can be gained is a positive. Well, speaking of guys, I love him dearly. As said, I worked with him a few years back and we proper connected and we keep in regular contact because of that. But when Man Like Mobin came out, I was so happy because it's so easy for a voice to get diluted or to get lost in the understandably long journey that is production. You know, there's going to be so many different hurdles to get over that things can get sanitized or watered down. And Gus feels so hard to sanitize.
Yeah.
What's great about him.
I think he's pretty resistant to it. I mean, that's been one of the glorious things about, you know, seeing him go from strength to strength. It's still him. Yeah. It's still him. It's just, you know, in a space where you just go like, rah, someone smart there has gone, I want that guy in my project. And you know, I remember, like, Guz and I hit it off when we worked together on an American sort of TV adaptation, I guess, of Four Weddings and a Funeral. And, you know, we played like childhood best friends and just got on like a house on fire. But yeah, I remember during the filming of that, he invited me along to go see him and Mo Amma. Yeah. It's a Palestinian American. His show's on Netflix at the moment.
Yeah, his new
he's
Netflix.
Doing amazingly. Shows
yeah, yeah, Mo.
And I just remember going to, you know, getting there. I went with a mate and seeing the queues snaking around Leicester Square Theatre, you know, past the Prince Charles. And I was just like, I've never seen a crowd that looks like this demographically.
Yeah.
The word diverse gets chucked around a lot. But I was like, yeah, there are just loads of, like, you know, there are loads of brown people, loads of people of colour, but just like coming to a gig in the center of town, and it's a special thing because I think a lot of the time people pay lip service, you know, commissioners and controllers and kind of, you know, we love that kind of appeal. But I think what's great with Guz is he's got that, and yet he's, you know, he's doing Judd Apatow movies and just like more power to him and then doing his bit to kind of signal boost a really worthwhile cause. But I think that's, you know, that's not put on. That's who he is.
No, I think that's what's great about Mobin is he got the perfect balance of bringing people from his community and from communities he relates to through, whilst also finding the right allies in people like Andy and all that, and Jill to kind of help that show get to where it needs to be, who are going to try and boost his voice rather than try and adapt it or take credit for or anything else.
100%.
Working with people like Shaheen in casting, who's just one of the best of the best, but just knows all the right people to go, how about this person? And will go above and beyond, particularly with a Midlands-based Asian community show.
Yeah.
It's the perfect combination.
You know, Series 4 is being made as we speak. I think because sometimes he makes it look easy, and the fact that it exists and we all love it and it has this fan base that I think, you know, doesn't get the flowers it deserves, maybe.
Yeah.
I think you and I can speculate there might be lots of reasons for that, but what's undeniable is it has its fan base. But, you know, I think he talked about this in an interview recently, like it sadly still feels like a bit of an outlier, like a bit of an example, like a bit of a unicorn of this thing that exists. But the flip side of that is hopefully it's inspiring, you know, not just the next one, but the next 10. You know, I worked on Series 3 with Guz, and he had an internship. He basically had loads of, like, kids. Got to sound like an old fart calling them kids. They're young adults, working in various roles. And it's just that mad thing of going, like, oh, yeah, you're the man at the top, and you spotted a gap, and you brought you brought this about. And it's definitely made me think, you know, as an actor, I'm sure you can relate to this on some level, but you are also like a creator. So you know, which I can't currently boast myself, but it's that weird thing of like, you recorded quite a lot of respect and, you know, just being on a set. It just that weird infantilizing thing of people falling over backwards to make sure you can get fast tracked to the front of the queue. That feels weirdly topical to talk about now, but for lunch and stuff. But then at the same time, like, you're not your voice can sometimes be lost. The reason I bring that up is it's just people like Guz make me realize that I have an opportunity, and it might not be as easy or straightforward when I join a project, to at least just ask a few questions about what are you guys doing about diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
And it can be as simple as that. It's just having a chat. And yeah, hopefully it's not a question that makes usually influential white people go, oh, crap. But they'll say, okay, we'll have a chat. We'll talk about it. And yeah, because otherwise with the best will in the world, it can kind of fall away. People get on a bit of a wave, like with anything, people get on a bit of a wave and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few months later, you know, the busyness of being in the industry and getting stuff made and beating that show and, you know, all of that, it kind of swallows it up.
Yeah, different things become the priorities. It's easy to, as you say, it's a weird one because you do have that kind of, you're put on a bit of a pedestal, as you were saying, in the kind of, you'll jump to the front of the queue or whatever else. But also... Yeah.
You're also occasionally, yeah.
It can also feel weirdly powerless. Like, it can feel hard because these things are such a big machine.
Yeah.
It feels hard to speak out or to make a stand and things like that. And that's why it's so important. And I completely agree. Guz puts in the work in things like these incentives and initiatives to get loads of young people in. And part of that is because the one part I disagree with you on is Guz makes it look easy, and sometimes I think it is annoyingly easy for that prick, because he'll just turn up and be effortlessly hilarious. Like, there was times where we were filming together where I had to make the choice to just have my back to camera, because he was just improvising stuff that was just killing me, and I was still too green at that point to hold it in. And it's like this amazing script. And then when I say, oh, we'll do a few takes improvised, he would just, like that, destroy it. And it's like,
also, it's difficult working with comedians, man. When they're, you know, their reason for being is to try and, like, fuck you up and make you coarse in a take.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you and I are maybe quite similar in our approach to, or how we look at acting, which is, you know, that focus on the role and kind of that, let that lead. Meanwhile, you've got this prick trying to just, like, you know, make us do as much as possible to just make everyone in the scene.
He woke up 4 minutes ago and he's improvising the best lines I've ever seen in my life. I was up 4 hours ago getting ready for this. He's a nightmare.
Yeah.
I hate him. but, I mean, you touched upon Four Weddings, and I want to talk about that because working with straight up icon Mindy Kaling icon for her work in The Office and everything else.
Yeah.
Working with Guz, but big American show, but it must have been kind of nice because there was a heavy Brit influence in there from like Bisha Ali on the writing staff to Natalie Emmanuel, Jamie Demetriou, Nathan Stewart, Jarrett Guz, all of these guys. Was that kind of comforting to be doing this big American Netflix show, big feel, huge deal, but you're surrounded by a load of Brits as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think maybe in ways that I took for granted as well, because it's the big American machine, but in a very familiar setting.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate. I did a show called Indian Summers a few years ago, which was, you know, you certainly couldn't say that wasn't a show with ambition and scale. But I just think the like budgets, man, for Four Weddings in terms of, you know, how they could kind of marshal what they wanted to get. Across the series in terms of locations, in terms of like, Andy McDowell's going to come in for a cameo and all this kind of thing. It's just like, but I think that a lot of that is down to kind of Mindy being at the sort of the top of that process. But what's really heartening as well is seeing, I mean, Mindy's gone from strength to strength with, you know, Never Have I Ever and Sex Lives of College Girls are doing hugely well.
Yeah.
But seeing people like Bisha, who in a funny way, we've since met, but we never got to meet in person because ironically she was in LA and I was filming in London, but I was just messaging going like, this is fucking cool. Cause you know, I guess we're got similar kind of backgrounds. We're both kind of brown kids from London working in the TV industry.
And speaking of going from strength to strength, you're looking at Loki and Miss Marvel and all of these.
Yeah.
Bish has been saying they're going to come on the podcast for a minute, and we're going to make it happen at some point. But, you know, that's another, again, as you say, that must be really comforting, as said, to have someone from a similar background, a similar life as you, fucking smashing it out.
Totally, yeah. And there's a really, like, funny, weird bit of serendipity because I think we DM'd on Twitter and then kind of bonded, you know, while we were filming Four Weddings. And I was like, okay, cool, you're a nerd like I am. So that immediately spiraled into talking about, like, Marvel stuff, a love of genre. And I was playing, you know, my character Cash in Four Weddings and a Funeral is a young Muslim guy from Hounslow who aspires to be an actor. And there was a bit where I just thought, I think it'd be quite fun. It's quite an innocuous scene where he comes in from his lunch break that I'd love for him to be reading a Miss Marvel, like bringing his food back and popping a Miss Marvel on the table. I don't know. I wasn't in regular enough contact that I mentioned that to Bisha. So I think I just spoke to production because, you know, as you know, there can be all kinds of like clearance issues.
Of course.
To get something, you know, even just a fleeting glimpse of a comic if you know, the higher ups don't agree. But for some reason, it went fine. It went quite smoothly. And then, however many months later, Bish is announced as the creator and showrunner of Miss Marvel. I was like, that is... And it's... I don't know if you've had a chance to see it. It's amazing. So,
it's astounding. Yeah.
It's so good.
I can't overestimate how much getting those small things over the line can mean. I worked on a show for NBC called Debris, and there was a few small things in that I was like, I've had this idea, and again, it probably won't get noticed by many people, but I know, I could see in your eyes as you were talking about that, how much it means to go, right, I've put something in here that's part of my own prep, that's part of my own work on the character, and regardless of how many people it means anything to, it means a lot to me, and it means a lot to my character, and those moments are buzz, man. They're a buzz.
And you're completely right. And it might just be for you, but also you and I both know that the internet's a big place.
Yeah.
Someone is going to spot what you brought and go, is that, has he done? And then it's not just for you. It's actually for someone who's kind of, you know, paying attention in a different way. So, you know, all that Easter egg stuff, I love it. And, you know, it's one of the things that I think is really smart about how, you know, what Tom Moran, he's written The Devil's Hour. I was like, the fans are going to go nuts for this because it's got kind of references all over the shop.
Yeah, yeah. Or let's talk a little bit about the Devil's Hour because more living legends here in Peter Capaldi and Jessica Ray. And it's like, it's an amazing one. I'll let you describe it more, but it's kind of a horror murder mystery feeling thing. And it had, for me, it had kind of the feel of, bit of the feel of Utopia and of like things like Seven. And I want to make it clear now, in my notes, I've put a Seven in place of the V because, you know,
yeah,
I'm
you
professional
know
on these things, even though no one else is seeing these notes. Tell the kind of the listeners a little bit about it as a show.
I describe it as a psychological thriller. You know, there are definitely kind of some pretty scary bits, but I wouldn't say it's like, I guess this is my appeal to people who are slightly squeamish. The hide behind your sofa count, I'm not gonna lie and say it's not there, but I wouldn't say that's the fabric of the show. I think there's a mystery at the heart of it. And loosely speaking, it follows Jessica Raine's character, Lucy, who's keeps experiencing these,
which is really weird because one of my partner's best friends is called Lucy Chambers. So the character is called Lucy Chambers. There's load. It keeps coming up. Who is Lucy? Where is Lucy? And I was like, well, this is weird, isn't it? But anyway, that's a side note.
That'd be deeply, should be deeply unsettled watching this then. But
yeah.
So Lucy's character, is woken up at 3:33, the same time every night with these really unsettling visions. And, you know, at the start of the series, it's sort of following her. We're finding out who she is. She's a social worker. She keeps experiencing these weird sort of like, almost like glitches rather than visions. And at the same time, there's a murder investigation happening, which is where mine and Alex Ferns' characters, we play a pair of detectives. My character's called Ravi Dhillon, and he is investigating a pretty grisly homicide and spots quite quickly that it bears a resemblance to a cold case from about 10 years ago that a lot of people have forgotten. And I guess without wanting to give too much away beyond that, Ravi's sort of on his path to trying to put this case together, which leads him towards Lucy and this really like complex web of coincidences and, you know, references. Yeah, you can tell I've got my like inbuilt spoiler gag on, but like it's at the heart of that web is Peter Capaldi's character.
Yeah. And it feels intricate like that. It's why it made me think of a Utopia and weirdly Sweet Tooth, which again, tonally is a completely different thing, but it is. It's that kind of, you're trying to figure out how things link and how these characters link and what the world we're working in is. And it's fascinating for that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember speaking to Tom while we were filming and saying, you know, was this ever conceived as a novel? And he said, no, he'd always set out to... that it was going to be a TV show, but it's interesting hearing him talk about, but he'd always had a plan that if it got stuck in development hell, then he'd, you know, he would have thought about publishing it as a novel. But it's Tom's a big sort of genre TV fan as well, and talked about things like Lost, and he's gone on record saying, you know, one of the great things about Lost is the way it teases out the mystery. One of the most frustrating things about Lost is a lot of the time that it wouldn't stick the landing, or it would throw up three more questions than it answered. And I think there's definitely, he's got a 3-year plan with this series.
Yeah.
And
that's good to hear, because big American shows, I think one of the problems, I'll often listen to podcasts with the writers, or when I had Kurt Sutter on, who I've worked with, and he'd say how on The Shield, half the time they'd start a big mystery and they wouldn't know how it's ending.
Yeah.
And they manage to nail it almost every time. But it's like, I'm sitting there pulling my hair out as a creator myself. It's like, no, I'd need to know everything. But the fact that they're going, oh, let's throw that in and we'll figure out how it pays off in a couple of seasons. It's like, man.
Yeah, definitely.
That's a risky game to play.
We were shooting stuff. Again, I'm worried about the, Amazon, Prime Video snipers waiting to take me out. But we were shooting stuff that's not going to pay off this series.
Yeah.
We're shooting stuff for series 2 and 3.
I love that, man.
And that's great, man. Exactly. You know that when you, because there are jobs where like they can barely deliver the script that you're shooting on time. And sometimes they don't.
Yeah,
you know, and it's just the pages, or they'll get rewritten.
It's a risky game to play in the era of shows getting cancelled and so on and so forth. But I love it when people do. Joe Barton recently did it with Lazarus Man. As soon as I finished that, I was like, "You've got a series 2, right?" He's like, "We don't know yet," and they have now. Yeah. But I was like, "You fucking prick! You'd better get a series 2 because the end of that, you're like, well, come on, I need this to continue." So yeah.
It must be mad. I mean, you write, and I know you write, it must be that mad thing of like, you don't want to be naive and not think about the marketplace and, you know, giving your work the best chance of getting made.
Yeah.
But then to also have the ambition to go like, I've got a plan here.
Yeah.
I've got a vision. Got to stick to that. Yeah.
It's the point of TV. It's the advantage of TV over film. I'm a massive film nerd, but the advantage of TV over film is for slow build, long-term storytelling, not having to fit it all in quickly. So... yeah, it's a beautiful thing. There's something I don't want to move on from, and that is that Alex Ferns is a fucking legend.
Man.
I worked with him on Taboo, on my first day on Taboo, and I was just looking, going, that's fucking Trevor off EastEnders.
Yeah, like, man.
Icon. And since then, he's in so many great things, from The Devil's Hour to Chernobyl, the fucking Batman, just in so many good things. And he's
in Andor.
Yeah.
I think he's in Andor soon. Yeah. Like, and
it's so weird because it's so hard. I had Himesh Patel on and we talked about how hard it can be to move on from soaps and stuff like that. And he seems to be doing it in a really subtle way. It's just he's popping up in so many astounding shows, and he's just so good. So I was excited to see him in this, and
Well, it's funny, you know. I think one recurring feature of the work I've got to do so far is that, you know, I like real life bromances, like we talked about Guz earlier, and Alex is exactly the same, man. And I don't think I'm wrong in saying that that eventually Tom started writing to that, because it could just see that, you know, we were fucking about in between takes, singing Tenacious D and you know, generally not taking life very seriously. And then, but yeah, it's that he's phenomenal. And you know, and he's had quite an unsung career, I think. And that's because of who he is. He's unassuming. He's not the polar opposite of a Lovie or someone who particularly plays the game. But I think that has a bearing on his work, you know, that his performance in Chernobyl was astonishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, getting to see, you've seen two episodes, right? Like, yeah, he unleashes some shit in this series that's going to be a pleasure to watch.
I can't wait. And I love having actors like that you get to go. I said the first time, and it happened to be on set, but the first time I was like, that's Trevor. The one who beat up Little Mo and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you start to see him more and more and go, oh shit, this guy's, as said, in Chernobyl, in all these things, he's astounding. Well, I mean, you mentioned earlier on the connection that you and Bisha had being a Londoner. Can we talk a little bit about you growing up in London and what was your kind of route into acting, I guess?
Yeah, of course. It was... I think early on, you know, because I think the more you get asked the question, the more you think, right, let me try and give a better answer next time, Nick. Actually, take stock of like what it is that where it all comes together. And I think as a kid, I was quite bookish. I know for some people, like being bookish was an escape from kind of life in a way. It wasn't particularly for me. I just really loved reading. I loved stories.
Yeah.
And that sort of came out in different ways. That would be like, you know, hoovering up whatever was on telly with my mum when we were at, like, you know, Friday night was Buffy the Vampire Slayer night. You know, like comics, Warhammer, all of it, man. I was deeply into it.
Well, that's all stories. That's all stories, exactly. From TV, you know, to Warhammer to comic books. It's all different mediums to absorb stories.
It's fire, yeah, exactly. It fires the imagination, and it's that thing about being lost in another world, and I guess also an element of like finding people who are as into it as you are. And then there weren't too many dabbles with acting, but I, you know, there were a few times at school. I was one of those very lucky people who had really good English teacher. I had a couple, but one in particular, shout out Richard Blanche.
His first name. Disrespect, mate.
Yeah. Go ahead. Man, it's still an adjustment. Like, I've not seen him for a little while, unfortunately. But you know, the first time that we caught up after school, and it was like, call me Richard, and I was like, I don't know if I can.
This is hard.
But you know, that thing of Shakespeare was a bit of a gateway drug for me at school, and I think what stopped it from being kind of dusty and inaccessible was good teachers who realized it was meant to be read out loud, and you know, young people who were ready to sort of just kind of say, this is fucking boring. You get them to put it on its feet and just see what happens. So even though I didn't really study drama at school, because that bit of it still felt, you know, at that point it was still like, oh, drama acting still feels a little bit inaccessible, still feels like something that I don't see a lot of people like myself doing. Actually, there were, you know, the seeds were being sown a little bit when I was at school.
Well, that must have been amazing then, when all those years down the line, you're doing Hamlet with legends like Andrew Scott and Jessica Finley Brown. And obviously, I love those two, but literal living legend.
Yeah.
Juliet Stevenson, who I've had on the podcast. I did a show called Out of Her Mind with Juliet. And honestly, my favourite memories of that show was just listening to Juliet backstage and quizzing her as if we were doing a podcast. Like when we finally did a podcast, it was like, this is just us, you know, in the green room.
Yeah.
Or in the van, you know.
Funny story about, so Juliet Stevenson. So first of all, Hamlet was interesting, because I think, so I played 14 brass in that version, but in that production, 14 brass only ever appears on video. So I've recorded all my bits. So I never actually, it's interesting. So I'd actually seen the production in a previous life. And then this thing came through, like, do you want to record? I know why the actor that they originally had down to play the part, it was something like he was unavailable, or even something even funnier than that. Like, he was shooting something and his hairstyle wasn't period appropriate or something like that. Which kind of made me go, like, I want to know what this hairstyle was. And I kind of wish they'd swung for it and just gone for the look. But yeah, so, you know, they're phenomenal actors, but I didn't get to share the stage with them. Yeah. But it was a hell of a production. But Juliet Stevenson was in did a show at the Young Vic called Happy Days, where she spends the whole show just, like, buried up to her waist in dirt and delivers, basically. There are other actors in the cast, but it's all her. And at the same time, I was doing this very sort of high concept. It was three short plays by Tennessee Williams. And if you think, like, Tennessee Williams is kind of melodramatic in his, like, celebrated work, his short plays are basically like that cranked up to 11. It's just like each one was basically a fucked up relationship between a man and his mother, or like a mother figure. So it was me and Justine Mitchell, who's an incredible actress. But basically, there was one particular scene change where in the first short play, I played like a 16-year-old, like, closeted gay man who swims out to sea and drowns himself. And in the second play, I play a guy in his 30s who's, like, virulently homophobic, but you find out that actually he's sending lewd pictures to men in the, and, you know, and so he's kind of like wrestling with that. But the scene changed for the two shows. I go from being in my Speedos, and then I got to run backstage, run into the shower, get soaking wet, and then run and pull some clothes on, and then run back on. But unfortunately, that point in our show always coincided with Juliet Stevenson in the hallway, just looking, you know, she's got a very regal presence and sort of just getting ready to go on stage. And for a good week and a half, I was the twat who basically just, like, barreled past her.
Ran past her in your Speedos.
In my Speedos, soaking wet. So I'd like to apologise to her, and I hope we get to meet in slightly less weird circumstances.
That's glorious. I absolutely adore that. So where was it? It was at uni, right, that you started to kind of get on stage and fall in love with that area.
Yeah.
At Warwick, so dangerously close to Guz Khan territory again.
That's right,
Not that this is the Guz episode, but it's seeming that way.
We're skewing towards the West Midlands, aren't we? So at uni, I think it was that thing. I'd sort of done bits and pieces in school plays, including, you know, being a nameless shark gang member in West Side Story. I think amazing. I feel like that's a rite of passage for any brown kid in theatre.
Love it.
And, you know, this was what, late 90s. So I definitely don't think whoever was in charge of casting was thinking too much about who was who had the right to play those roles. But at uni, I think I auditioned for a play and then ended up playing the lead in Othello, which was just like a huge, I loved it. And and then after that, I just slowly started doing more. And by the end of uni, I was spending more time learning lines than I was revising for my finals. And it still wasn't clear to me that there was a way to keep that going.
What were you doing?
Really even think, I was doing English literature. I think for the longest time I was engaging with that love of stories and kind of, and maybe resisting an office job or anything that would make me, but I got to the end of drama school I got to the end of uni and I had friends that I was acting with going, have you thought about applying to drama school? And my response wasn't that far off basically saying, like, what's that? And, you know, and I didn't even have a particularly, I would say, sheltered upbringing. I'd been exposed to and seen a lot of, like, culture and stuff, but it was just a bit of the profession and the world that I didn't really know about. But then I did my homework and, yeah, I remember sitting down with my parents and being quite terrified of how they might respond. And that terror was all completely self-generated, because actually they were wicked. They said,
"Yeah,
we can tell you're passionate about this, and you've always knuckled down and you have to academically. So even though we don't get this world, and I thank God that they don't, because if they'd known how unstable the profession is, they would have gone, no fucking way. But, but you know, my parents, I've said this before, my parents are both pharmacists, and the one bit of careers advice they gave to me was, son, don't be a pharmacist, you know, you know, find your own lane. So it's interesting. I went from uni to drama school for another 3 years, and then, graduated 2010. And in a year with some brilliant, like very successful actors now. Lily James was in my ear, Mark Stanley, Ashley Jangaja, Freddie Fox, like, you know, people that have gone on to have brilliant careers. And that was my way in, man. Because, you know, one of the things that drama school did was, I mean, it gives you a training, but also it brings the industry to you.
Yeah, I was going to say, it'll also often give you access to agents or casting directors and all things like that. It's one of the things I've only learnt via the podcast, that part of drama school is the business side of the industry as well, which is fantastic. You know,
and I think, you know, that was a long time ago, and I think, you know, there are different routes available now, and it's definitely not. I loved my time there, and I think it set me up. And it gave me the confidence, you know, part of that 3 years is having a space to fuck up and not be judged for it. But it doesn't, you know, that system doesn't work for everyone. And what's amazing now is seeing people coming up that have, you know, got it through YouTube or got it through, again, you know, Guz is a classic example.
Well, we can't start talking about Guz again.
All right, fuck Guz. We talked about him enough.
Right. Really, again, the finding... Yeah. The different routes to find your audience, to get in, and the beauty of that, of going of those routes, is that can sometimes be the best way to get to make the work that you want to make. Because if you've already proven it off your own back on YouTube, on TikTok, on wherever else, then it's a proven entity. Whereas if you're coming to a production company or channel or whatever else, from drama school or anything like this, with just an idea, then it's easier for them to go, well, that's not going to work, and this might work, and we'll tweak this and tweak that. Whereas if you're going, look, it already works, let's make it work on a bigger scale, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think there's also something about, you know, I think it works both ways. Like, reflecting on my route into the profession, it's given me, I guess, like a confidence and a comfort with being in certain rooms and talking to certain people, because, you know, there's an element of just like, you get to see how those institutions and those establishments operate.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that is, if you don't belong to that world, then sometimes you've got the balls to just go, well, this is what I want to do, why can't we do it like this? And I think sometimes I've got to remind myself that I need to have a bit more of that about myself sometimes.
And it needs constant reminding as well. I've had that a few times where I've had someone give me a kick up the arse and remind me that in music or in podcasting or whatever else, I didn't ask for anyone's permission. And then I'll have a few months of being like, yeah, man, fuck everyone, I'm doing this myself. And then it'll be like, oh, this production company wants to talk to me. Oh, I'll bow and curtsy. Let's go there. It's like, man, no, you need to, it's a weird balance, isn't it?
I was just going to ask, what was your route into acting? Did music come first?
It's weird. Prior to doing music, I was trying to make short films with my mates. But then the music happened and it took off. And that was like, man, this is a treat. And then I'll be brief on my story, because we're here to talk about you. I had people like Riz Ahmed and Simon Pegg and Paddy Considine all saying, like, when are you going to go back to the go? Because they, from talking to, it's all I wanted to talk about from them. Yeah. I wanted to hear all their stories. They were like, it's clearly what you want to do. So I decided to take a year off from music and give it a try. And I emailed a load of casting directors, had no agent or anything. And one casting director I couldn't find a contact for was a guy called Reg Poor Scout Edgerton, which is a distinct name, so it's going to stand out.
It's an expensive name. You don't forget it.
I couldn't find it. He'd done Guardians of the Galaxy and a few other things I really liked. And I got an email from him the next day. And I was like, yesterday I'd never heard of this name. And now this name is in my inbox. And he was casting a thing and him and Guy Ritchie wanted me to audition for it. I was like, man, that's just weird that no one knew I was focusing on acting now or trying acting and all this. It was just weird timing. And then, I got my first couple of acting gigs in that first year and realised I'd never wanted to do anything other than this again.
That's great.
I was also dead lucky to work with Stephen Graham early on, who took me aside and said, look, it sounds like it's going wicked. Be aware that isn't how this industry works. You're not going to go from gig to... I went from a TV show to a film... No, a film to a TV show to another TV show, all within... the first kind of year, 18 months. And Stevie was like, awesome. Congratulations. Yeah. Now let's look at reality. And it prepped me so much, man, because it's a crushing
industry
as well.
Otherwise your feet don't touch the ground. And then, and then when they do, it's just like, like you said, it's crushing.
Yeah. So, I mean, mentioning Riz there, Riz was one of the early episodes of this. And I know Riz from back doing... rapping together and all that kind of thing, and he talked about around that time that you were coming in, around, you know, 2010 ish maybe a little bit earlier for Riz, but he was finding that being a young Asian man in the UK, he was only being put up for or considered for a certain kind of role, and for him it was either gangster or terrorist, essentially.
He went to America.
He went to America and did like Nightcrawler and just all these other amazing things. What was your experience of being a young Asian man? Like I said, you came out of drama school with some fucking people who've gone on to do amazing things as well. Yeah. What was your experience coming out as the only brown person in that list of people you gave me?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the... I've done a lot of reflection on that time and my experience, and I think luck played a part in just feeling like I came out confident and I didn't feel particularly penned in. And so much of that, when you're at drama school, can be down to the opportunities that you're given. Specifically, we're talking casting, you know, and I think there was a wave of what was then called colorblind casting, particularly in theatre, which meant that we didn't need to get bogged down in socio-political factors, let's say, when it came to deciding how we were going to cast the Shakespeare or whatever. But is it like, I mean, Riz has played such an important part in kind of blazing a trail for that the rest of us can follow in. I think what's heartening now is it is opening up, you know, and it's interesting looking at, name-checked Mindy earlier, and it's really exciting the possibilities that are opening up for women, particularly South Asian women, in shows like the ones that Mindy's done, Bridgerton. I don't know, it's casting just feels like it's more interesting now. What's interesting with Devil's Hour and actually with Starstruck was that they were both shows on paper that weren't coded specifically South Asian. But what happens, you know, someone's got to write the thing and they've got to give characters names. So it's quite an interesting thing that phenomenon that happens when you're... when you get sent something, you're like, yeah, they want to open this up and see anyone for this part. You're like, great. And then I played Ravi Dhillon in The Devil's Hour, but that first script, he was called Alec Mason. I was like, cool, okay, I'm
I was going to say, they're really open to cast this character, but, Dave.
But yeah, exactly. Dave? Exactly.
Are they?
Yeah. But then I chatted to Tom on set about that, and he said, yeah, he said, it's interesting you bring that up. There's nothing malicious there, but it's me writing what I know, and what I know is a certain pool of stuff. So with that, with both those jobs, I had a chat with Tom on... actually, I had a chat with Johnny Allen, who was our lead director on Devil's Hour, and with Rose Matafeo about Starstruck, just about tweaking the names and, you know, just to have a bit of a nod to heritage, to my heritage. And there'll be projects where I'm like, I'm not fussed about making that tweak because it doesn't feel like it's particularly important. But with this, I just thought, with Devil's Hour, I just thought this project's so cool and it's so great to like see a brown detective on screen.
Yeah.
Like I saw, you know, don't want him to be called Alec Mason. So,
yeah. Yeah, completely. It's mad, isn't it? Because, again, like, talking to Riz back then, the reason he felt he couldn't get cast in things is because in the UK we're obsessed with making period dramas. Ooh. And it's mad that you mentioned Bridgerton.
Well, the change, it's messing with the formula.
The change that came wasn't stopping making period dramas. It was just opening up the race options in that. Again, I love that England was like, look, whatever we do, we can't stop making period. Like, that's the bit we have to do. But okay, let's open it up to all. Or let's do, as you said, the colorblind casting, and we'll have some fun with it.
Which is amazing because actually, like, you know, that genre has such a huge fan base that kind of, you know, that isn't just made up of the people that wasn't just for white people. You know, there are, and so I just think it's. I think it's great that those fans get to now see themselves reflected back in those stories. And it's interesting. I think particularly with South Asian representation, I don't speak with any authority, but one of the things that I'm just drawing on personal experience, but one of the things that lockdown afforded was a chance to just, you know, the phone wasn't ringing, right? We all just like kind of down tools and had a bit of time to kind of take stock. And for me, that was, you know, what is it? What is it that's driving me? What's the kind of work I want to do? And something that you can sort of, when you get into the grind of it, you can sort of forget to go like, oh yeah, why am I doing this?
It's because you get so excited when the phone does ring. It's so mad. Yeah. I said in that downtime, it's so easy to analyze things. But then the phone rings, you're like, I don't know if it's an imposter syndrome thing or what, but you're kind of like, they want me? Rather than thinking anything about what do I want to do and what is this? It's like this weird, the phone has rung. Shit, let's jump
for
on
sure.
It.
And I think particularly with remember coming together with a few friends who we're all sort of aware of each other and then kind of, you know, met at, you know, a party or something, or in some cases like in the casting room where you come away from it going like, they're sick. Why is it that we only ever meet when it's in this weird sort of industry thing where you're like dangling a part that we've got a, you know, something feels like you've got a scrap for it. Yeah. So like, you know, you mentioned Himesh. Sasha Dewan's another, Anjali Mahindra, like people that are like going on to do great stuff. And, you know, it's interesting taking stock of the cultural footprint of South Asians in this country is a lot more significant than in the States, if we're talking historically, and like the impact on the culture. And yet it's interesting that the biggest moves are being made, I guess, if not directly in the States, like with US backing. Or that clout. And I think part of that is, you know, you just got to acknowledge the power that Hollywood has, and sort of being able to play in that ball pit then makes you more appealing. But I don't know, it's genuinely something that I'm not grappling with it in some sort of like painful way, but it's something that I keep coming back to is South Asian people have been part of the fabric for this country for a long time. And part of the issue even with like period dramas and stuff is it's almost like a TV storytelling version of that quote, like history is often told, is a tale told by the victor. Mm-hmm. But like people of different races and ethnicities were about.
Got it. Sorry, I've just...
Oh, look at that.
I've got that quote on the painting behind me. But
there you go. Like, you know, and I think what's exciting now is that there are a bunch of new writers, literally and figuratively, that are sort of entering and going, well, I either want to play with the formula, like do a Bridgerton with it when it comes to colorblind casting, or just go, I'm jumping around in my thoughts a little bit now. But I think this is what I mean when I was talking about sometimes when you have like an establishment weigh in for a lot of us getting work in this industry means the phone rings, you get a call and you've been rewarded by the establishment, a production company or a job or a director. That thing you said, they want to work with me. That's amazing. But then sometimes you got to step back and remind yourself that not all of that stuff is that exciting actually.
Yeah.
Or that stimulating and just to step back and go, all right, well, that's what's available out there. But what if I want to subvert that? Or what if I want to That's why I think, you know, reconnecting with the stuff that you loved as a kid is so powerful, because I think we lose that sometimes, and you go like, oh yeah, actually I want to be on a spaceship, or like, I want to be a cowboy. Like, you know,
100%. There's a million, like, I'm a proper Indian European cinema nerd, right? There's so many cool indie films, all this, that I'd love to be working on. Anytime a Star Wars or Marvel audition comes through, I'm losing my shit. Because again, it's not the indie stuff, but it's like, that's what I grew up on, and that's what I love as well. I've got a stack of comic books there, and exactly. I feel you on that. I can spend all this time thinking, oh, I'd love to do this, or I've got my own projects I want to make and things like that. Everything gets thrown aside as soon as I get an NDA through.
That's it.
Saying, yeah, you can't even look at this script until, oh, it's gonna be Marvel or Star Wars. Send it.
I know. So, you know, I think, this is a long-winded, slightly rambly answer to your original question, but I think there are definitely strides being made in the right direction. If you've been away from the centre in any way, whether that's race, class, gender, sexuality, then I think a lot of the time that change doesn't feel quick enough, or it's progressing at a pace, but you're like, yeah, but think about how exciting it could be if we were there, you know. And I definitely feel both of those things. I can't lie. I feel hugely fortunate with the stuff that I've worked on and the people that I've worked with. And maybe this comes from, you know, slightly feeling like a bit like I have my feet under the table and a little bit of, you know, I'm gonna knock wood, a little bit of security. In terms of, you know, being in stuff that's been watched. And but I think there's also that thing of going, no, come on, if you had a blank slate, or if you had, you know, if you had whatever the adult version of the make-believe box that a kid gets, and then he pulls this out and goes, all right, today we're going here, like, what would that look like? And I think that's what I've got a bit of downtime now. And I think resisting the urge to just fire up the PS4 and get lost in that and just kind of think about what that is. And so, yeah, that a lot of that is just, I guess we're talking development, you know, getting together with like-minded people and going, you know, what could this be?
It's why people like Gaz and Riz are so inspirational, because they're people who've got their feet firmly under the table and they've pulled out their compass and started scratching new scripts into the table and new paths and new narratives, and they're smashing the table up and doing all sorts, and it's inspirational. But I want to just touch upon something quickly, because you spoke a lot about a representation there. And there's something that I only realised really in recent years of working with the British Stammering Association. I always stammer on the word stammer as if it's to prove I've got a stammer. But one of the things I've learned a lot with them is that representation is for everyone, because, it's really important. And I learned this with films like Black Panther as well, growing up in quite a white area. Yeah, it's important for young Asian kids to see a show like this on Prime, I Like the Devil's Hour, where the lead detective looks like them. But it's also important for their white classmates to see a brand. And again, we talk about it a lot at Stammer, because stammering does seem to be a disability that's been left behind in the push for representation, whether it be races, sexualities or disabilities. It seems to be one that isn't observed. And the thing I ranted about in a video was 2% of people in the UK, or no, 2% of adults have a stammer. Right. And that's a lot of people, but it's the 98% that's more important, because that's where the problems come in. It's people not being used to stammers or feeling stammers are unusual that makes it a problem. If we have more representation, and again, it's the same with all races and cultures, it's a lack of understanding that makes people racist or resistant or whatever else. So that representation isn't only for the communities it's representing, it's for everyone else as well. It's for the communities who need to be exposed to it more. And it's just, it makes it feel like an even bigger and more important thing. Do you know what I mean? Because it's literally, it affects everyone. It's
for sure. And it's not always about, you know, that those 98% are all going to be bigoted or hateful. But if you're invisible to them, then they don't have the chance to have that attitude, you know, to form an attitude or to understand or
to get comfortable with these things, to get exactly to relax. you know.
And then that colours unconscious bias and all the rest of it. And, you know, whereas if we're all bumping into each other from an early, you know, it's, you know, kids aren't bigoted, they learn it.
No, man.
They don't discriminate. Like, yeah. You get that from somewhere. Sometimes it's a straightforward, you know, you get that from your parents, but sometimes it's like you get that from the conditioning, whether that's the society around you, or, and this is where, you know, this is where you kind of take stock of your responsibility when your job is essentially you get paid to put on clothes and do voices and entertain people. But it's like you kind of shape people's view of yeah. what's out there. Yeah. So, I mean, that 2% is that's a huge...
It's a small number, and it's not a small number. You know?
It's not a small number. Yeah.
It's a weird one. But, I mean, I think that's a perfect kind of note to start to wrap things up on. I've taken an hour of your time. So I kind of want to just ask what's ahead, because I was looking at IMDb and I'm seeing The Critic with, you guessed it, more living legends. And I feel like I'm listing all these legends as if you're not a legend. I don't want to discredit you here, but Jim Ratton and Mark Strong, Leslie Manville, and Sir Ian fucking McKellen. That sounds mad. I'm not familiar with it at all. But yes, so kind of what's ahead, I guess.
Yeah, so we shot that earlier this year, and I've got a small part in that, but it's a murder mystery set in theatre land. So you've got lots of like intrigue and scheming. Ian McKellen plays a veteran theatre critic who starts blackmailing this actress played by Gemma Arterton. So that he can keep his job. And, it's written by Patrick Marber, who wrote, you know, he wrote Closer, he wrote Don Juan in Soho. Like, he's terrific. The read through for that, there's, you know, all the stuff in your that goes through your active. Also, you must know this, read throughs are kind of, they're weird anyway. Because you sort of, it's sort of like being back in the canteen at school. And you're like, who do I sit with? I don't want to look like a twat. Except into your canteen walks Gandalf, and then you completely lose your shit.
Yeah.
I don't know when that's I don't know when that'll come out. We shot that earlier this year, and yeah, it was
sounds amazing.
A huge privilege to be part of that. And then got the third series of Starstruck.
Yes,
start filming that in Jan, which can't wait for.
Just so you know, in my notes, Rose is on my list of legends as well. We just didn't get around to talking about it, but I don't want to leave Rose off there. But yeah,
no, man, no, like she's multiple. I don't even think she's triple threat. I think we've just got to say she's multiple threat.
She sort of
does it all. And then hopefully the plan is for more Devil's Hour. So fingers crossed, it comes out next month. So hopefully you people like yourselves get sucked into it and get their fix, and then we get to do more of it.
I can't wait. Well, it's been a pleasure, man. I'm glad we got to chat. I said it feels like it's been a long time coming, but it seems like the timing was perfect, so I appreciate you taking the time.
You too, man. Likewise.
Nice one.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Nikesh Patel. Loads of nerd out moments there, man. From comic book nerd out moments to Alex Ferns nerd out moments. You weren't expecting that. I was ready. I'm going to be back next week with another wonderful guest. I'll see you then, probably, unless you pop into one of my Twitch streams between now and then and have a little natter. Stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.